Okay, let's begin. Who's not the one I want? I want this one. So, oh, I just mentioned to someone who came to see me earlier. I did disclose to you guys that I have ADHD. With ADHD, if anybody here has it, we tend to move faster. And in our brain, we think we're going slow. Now, Brian is very passionate about this material. And the more he enjoys it, the faster he gets. And he likes to talk very, very quickly because he's excited about it and he gets moving. So sometimes you need to remind me to say, whoa, put the brakes on, Brian. You're kind of going fast. Now, I'm fast anyways. I'm sure you guys noticed that on Monday that I go pretty quick. And in my mind, I'm talking like this. That's an ADHD. So that's what happens. So just let me know sometimes. So again, same idea. Callum, please there, contact me, my office, all that kind of stuff, which is all the offices are straight across over there. So my office is on that side over there. We've done the outline, we've done the syllabus. Oh yeah, the course study guide. Oh shoot, I forgot to download that. Okay, give me a split second here. I will download that right now. And I'll put it on your blackboard. Just give me half a second. Sorry, I forgot all about that. Where are we here? I'm going to put this into week one. Of course, I can't find it just because I'm looking for it in a hurry. Oh, where are we here? Okay, so let me go. Okay, so I just put this in. If you have your computers with you, I put it just below the day one information. It's called the study guide. It's a Word document. And what this is to help you somewhat organize your material. Also, it shows a few things here. So the first thing is obviously the title page. And then one thing that's here that I spoke to someone about in your class this week earlier, that you I've given you a bit of a graph or a bit of a chart here. So when you're learning the muscles or the structures, you can start listing them out. So the structure or the muscle, its attachments, how do you landmark it for palpation in the lab? How do you confirm it? What action does the muscle do in nerve innervation? So some students like to create those sorts of organizational spreadsheets to help them remember all the information. So it's there for you. You can download it. It won't be, it's not PDF, so you can, you could use this if you wanted to study the material. So on here as well, ooh, why this thing is not fitting. It's kind of odd. Okay, so you can see here now for week one, okay, this is what we're doing, the key points. So I put the key points of what we're going to talk a little bit about today on here. And then below it, I have prepped for week two. So here is all the things we'll talk about probably next week. So it gets you kind of ahead of the game. And then self-study for week two, look up ligament versus tendon, structural versus functional joints, and so forth. So it's sort of laid out for you there. And when we get to muscles, in week two, getting ready for three, I've got all the I had to double check those pages, but I think they're correct. There's all the muscles that we will be learning, for example, that week. Okay, so it's a study guide that you can print off and use yourself and to your advantage. So it's now in Blackboard, and I apologize, I forgot to put it in there. So if you don't have your computer right now, that's okay. I was Musculino Muscles, Larry. Okay, so that's the study guide. I apologize, I forgot to put that in there. So, you know what this is now, right? Okay, so we use it here as well. So when I'm talking about relationship of muscles or bones to each other, everything always defaults to that, right? That's what we have to remember. The planes are the same here. We have to think about these because now I'm going to be discussing joints and muscles and movement, right? So particular movements that the body does in relationship to the muscles and the bones. So, you know, they move through the particular planes that we have to remember. We've got this one again for AB and adduction. We said divides the body into anterior, posterior. It because it goes over the head in a crown-like fashion is the reason why it's called the coronal plane, but it also can be called the frontal plane, which we can see here on the left. The transverse plane, of course, exactly what it says. It runs in the transverse way, divides the body into superior and inferior. And that transverse plane can be at the belly button, down by the hip, up in the chest, through the head. It makes no difference. It's just the fact that it's transverse. Yes. Day one anatomy. Yeah. Are you in the clinical anatomy? Yes. You guys knew that it expands and contracts, right? So maybe some of you didn't know that. It looks like there's nothing on Blackboard, but if you click on the day one box, it expands and then all the slides are there. Okay. Yeah.
So but for the transverse, you said
Yeah, so it's mid-sagittal or parasagittal. All the other ones don't change the name if they move. Because even the frontal plane can come forward or back in the body. But it's still just the frontal plane. Maybe the front part's a little bit smaller than the back because the planes come a bit forward.
They're not necessarily equal planes.
No. Now, if you look at the transverse plane here, right, there's a test that uses this plane. Maybe some of you have done it. Yeah, a test that you lie in a machine and it makes pictures of your body, an MRI. So what happens is there's this huge magnet that actually, from a picture perspective, slices you in a transverse plane so that it slice, and then through the screen of the computer, they can try to travel through the body and see what's going on inside. I won't get into the mechanics of an MRI, but that's how an MRI works. It just slices you that way using a magnet. The median mid-sagittal plane, of course, you can see it here. So we can see that we have here is the mid-sagittal here, and then we have a parasagittal here. It's moved off the midline, hence the reason why it's called para. Okay? And of course, there's your transverse there as well. So it divides into right and left. It's down the middle, is mid-sagittal, and when it's off midline, it's called the parasagittal. And we can see it there in the middle one. The oblique plane it happens more often than not, usually in anatomical textbooks. It's not really considered a true anatomical plane, but it is something that can be cut so we can see sometimes, again, in these anatomy apps, they may show you this cut, and then this whole part of the head gets removed so you can see what's inside in the area where that piece has been removed. You can look down and see whatever structures, tissues, and so forth lie in there, okay? When we look at planes, when we discuss muscle contraction and its influence on limb movement at joints, the limbs move through any one of these planes. So that's what you have to remember. Again, abduction and adduction is through the frontal plane, and flexion and extension would be through a sagittal plane, right, and so forth, okay? So if you have front, and so here's the plane dividing me into anterior, posterior. My arm is traveling through that plane, or my leg is traveling through that plane when abduction, adduction is occurring.
Then you'd automatically say it's the anterior, not posterior.
Like it's actually traveling through the plane, neither anterior nor posterior.
Okay, so that's what I think.
Yeah. So you're actually plane flexion of the shoulder is sagittal, be parasagittal, right? Okay. Yes. But don't get caught up in that. That's why the seated ones don't work very good. Because the moment you go into 90 degrees flexion, you've changed the attitude or angle to the muscle that you want to work in the first place. If you truly want to do in the gym pure AB and adduction, it's cable, so that movement's more pure. The moment you sit down, suddenly now you're doing this, right? It's entirely different exercise. Okay, so this is glute meet, glute min, glute max. This, sitting and doing it, is piriformis, an entirely different muscle that does entirely different things. Trust me, when it comes to gym, I will change your life. Because I go into the gym and watch what's going on, and I'm like, oh my freaking Lord, what are they doing? You talk to me, you know the number one exercise I can't stand? Can't stand, and nobody should be doing them. Deadlifts.
Yeah.
Deadlifts. If you want to have a disc in your lumbar spine when you get to be my age, don't do deadlifts. Think of it just grinding that disc down. Yeah, but to get the correct mechanics to do a deadlift, you have to be in really good shape. So the average person that goes to CrossFit and is doing these damn things and they're barely trained, guess what they're doing? They're hurting themselves. You guys have no idea. How many people here do CrossFit? Seriously, how many people here do CrossFit? Nobody? Yeah? Okay. You have no idea the amount of injuries I've seen at a CrossFit gym. It's phenomenal how many injuries I've seen. Because people get motivated to do things they're not in the fitness level to actually be doing. Again, if you're really highly fit, some of those exercises are phenomenal, but not for the normal Joe who's just trying to get off the couch and do something, right? What's that? No. You know, the competitions when they do the wide grips, they're kipping and doing all these things. Yeah, excuse me. Yeah, it's awesome. Or good mornings. I can't stand good mornings either. So these are just the movements that occur, and we're going to talk a lot about them. Now, I'm going to go back to the terms a little bit of movement, because I'm going to use those terms in terms of the effect that the muscle has on the limb or the joint. Okay? So we have superior, inferior, which we already talked about, anterior, posterior, dorsal, and ventral, medial, and lateral. So I could say, right, the muscle lies ventrally or anterior to this structure or superior, inferior, depending on what my reference is, right? Those are the ones we talked about on Monday. They're relatively easy. Now, there's contralateral and ipsilateral. Contralateral is when a muscle on the right makes you turn left. So muscle on the right turns you away from the side of that muscle. That is contralateral. If the muscle on the right causes you to move in the same side as the muscle we're talking about, that is known as ipsilateral. So when we're talking about spinal muscles, it depends on where they are. They either make the body turn away from the muscle we're talking about or to turn into the muscle we're talking about. So when it's turning away, it's called contralateral. And when it's on the same side, it's known as ipsilateral. For example, sternocleidomastoid is a muscle in your neck. It is a contralateral rotator and an ipsilateral lateral flexor. We will get back to that. Don't worry. Yeah. You're learning a whole new language. Okay? Yeah, so let's come on up. I use you guys a lot. Okay. So, sternocleidomastoid runs from the mastoid process at this point that we can see here and comes down here into the sternum clavicular area here, okay? So what I'm going to get you to do is just stay here. I want you, all of you, to sort of look on this side. I'm going to ask you to look to the left in a moment, and I'm going to prevent it. So you don't use all your strength, just okay? So try to look to the left. You see it stick out? Okay, so that's SCM, okay? So when SCM contracts, so whenever we look at an action of a muscle, when a muscle contracts, it gets from this length and it goes to this length. It shortens. Okay, when a muscle contracts, it shortens. When it does that, it brings the two attachments closer together. So my biceps, for the moment, stay there, right, attaches down here on the radius and comes all the way up here to the shoulder. So when biceps contracts, it's bringing this attachment closer to this attachment, right? Understand? Okay, so thinking of sternocleidomastoid then, we have the mastoid process here and the clavicle sternum here. So now turn to the left. Have they gotten closer together? Yes, they have. Anatomically, they have their farther part here. Look at it from this. No, don't move from it. Look at this, see where this is? This is farther back. This is more forward. Turn to the left. See how they got closer together? Right? Now I want you to, with your head in this position, I want you to bring your right ear down towards the floor. That way, that's it. Now, did I make them closer again? Right. So because the right is contracting and she turns left, it's contralateral. And because when she laterally flexes and brings the mastoid process closer to the clavicle, because the right one is causing right movement, it's ipsilateral. Okay? Thanks. Make sense? Kind of, sort of? Okay, don't worry. It's going to come back over and over and over again. Proximal and distal, we already did, right? Proximal is closer to the mid. Distal is a bit further. Superficial and deep. That kind of makes sense, right? Internal, external. So we use those also in coordination with rotation. It gets a bit confusing. So if you take my hand and my shoulder rotating, medial rotation brings my hand closer to the midline, correct? Medial rotation. That also can be called internal rotation. And then when my hand gets further away from the midline, that would be lateral rotation or external rotation. So lateral and external and internal and medial can be used either or, which everybody goes, why? Because just the way it is. We have different names for the same thing quite often. And you will get used to them. I know it seems, oh my God, now, but you'll get used to it, I promise. The last one is bilateral and unilateral. When we're looking at muscle action, so we have two SCMs, right? We have a right one and a left one, okay? When the right one's working, as we said, it's a contralateral rotator, ipsilateral lateral flexor. That is known as its unilateral action. So when just the one, because it's a right and left, when just the right one's contracting, one muscle, unilateral rotation, lateral flexion. When both SCM work at the same time, it is flexion. So that it's its bilateral responsibility because both sides are working. Unilateral is just the one working. Bilateral is when they both work. So there's many muscles, for example, in the spine. Unilaterally cause this, bilaterally cause that. Okay? So you're going to have lots of practice with those terms, trust me. So we can see them here, all the particular planes here. We can see how it divides the body. And I like this picture because it's what you're going to see in anatomical textbooks. So the coronal or frontal plane here, you can see the whole anterior half of this diagram has been removed, right? And you're looking at the posterior aspect of this body, looking at everything and all its organs and muscles and so forth. Over here, this is a mid-sagittal cut. So So we've removed, in this case, the right side, and we're looking at the inside of the left side of the body. And then a transverse cut we can see here. This would represent here, this is the spine and the ilium of the pelvis that we can see here. We can see the ends of the arms kind of where they hang down, and we're looking at the internal organs inside the abdominal cavity there. So this is the kind of cuts you might find in an anatomical textbook, kind of to show you the relationship of structures in deep inside the body when you're looking at it. We did them already on Monday. We can see here anterior, posterior, ventral, dorsal, caudal down towards the lower part of the body, cranial to the head, and of course medial to the center, lateral to the outside, proximal closer to the core, distal farther away, right? And remember, proximal distal is pretty much exclusively used in the limbs, not in the core of the body. Yeah. When the author decides to.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because certain professions will use one versus the other, right? Chiropractor uses caudal quite often, whereas your family physician would use inferior. So it can be professional specific for whatever reason. Usually inferior, superior, more often than not. We'll talk about it. But yeah, they tend to use a little bit of different language, and you'll find that with all the kinds of different professions, depending on what they're working with. Most movements are defined in relationship to the anatomical position. These movements occur within and around axes aligned with specific anatomical points. So, when we look at two bones coming together, what do we call that? A joint. So, I'm just going to create some sort of bone here, joint. And it's going to sit inside some sort of socket here. It doesn't really matter what it is. And this bone is going to move. Okay? So let's say for now, this bone can either move this way or this way. What we're saying is the movement of that bone is occurring at this point right here. Right? Everybody understand that? So in other words, it's either going this way or it's going this way, depending on which way it's moving. All right, so we have an axis, okay? That's where the movement occurs. All right, so we say these movements occur within and around axes aligned with specific anatomical planes. Most of these movements occur at joints where two or more bones or cartilages articulate. Now, there are some non-articular things that move. Your lips, your eyelids, and so forth. They still use muscles, but they don't have bones that kind of come together and form an articulation of movement, right? So what I want you to understand is that where two bones articulate is an axis or a center of movement, right? How many people here took physics? Nobody takes physics anymore, okay? So you all know what an axis is, right? Right? Where's an axis in your car? What's that? The door to some degree, steering wheel, right? Your steering wheel, the steering column is the axis. Your hands move around the axis when you're turning the car. Same thing here, okay? Now, I'm going to say this a couple times, but I'll say it first today. Muscles are stupid, okay? Muscles are stimulated by the nervous system and they contract. That's all they know. But Brian, you told me that muscle is a contralateral rotator, ipsilateral lateral flexor. So what do you mean it just all does is contract? When we look at a muscle and we're trying to understand its role, when I tell you what it does, whatever it may be, it's where that muscle lies in relationship to the axis that it influences that movement. Does everybody understand what I'm saying there? For example, if we have an axis here, whatever joint that is, and we have a muscle that sort of originates down here and attaches there, what direction will that move around the axis? Remember I said that when a muscle contracts, the two points get closer together. So in other words, this is going to get closer to that. So what direction is the muscle going to move? Right, it's going to move this way, correct? Now if I place a muscle here and attach it down here, what direction is that muscle, going to move. It's going to move this way. Good. If I place a muscle here and I attach it there, what direction is the muscle going to move? That way. Does everybody understand it? Okay, so rule number one. A muscle only affects a joint if it crosses that joint. Okay? So if I go back here, if a muscle is going to affect this joint, it might have an attachment here, but it has to cross that joint and have an attachment maybe somewhere here. It's crossed the joint, therefore it's going to affect movement at that joint. A muscle that does not cross the joint will not affect that joint. Okay? For example, in the gym, there's usually a machine where you get in it and your feet are hanging and your arms are in the thing and everybody's bringing their knees up, right? And what do they think they're working? Right. Here's the problem. Do your abdominal muscles cross your hip joints? No. So guess what? If you truly wanted to work your abs, the joints it crosses are in the spine. It has nothing to do with your hip joints. This is the movement that rectus does. Okay? It doesn't do this because it doesn't cross that. Iliopsoas crosses that, which is an entirely different muscle. Iliopsoas is called a hip flexor. And we all walk around like this because our hip flexors are always tight because what do we do all day? Sit. Okay? So getting in that frame and doing those leg swing things all over the place, you're not doing any abdominal work at all. Working out in the gym is one of those things I've never been able to figure out why we don't use new science. We still get stuck in all these things in the past, right? All the time. It's craziness to me. I don't understand it. Yeah, I know. Right. So for abdominals, then, of course, would be crunches. And then from an isometric point of view, as we all know now everybody's doing, it is core work, right? Getting all the muscles in the core strong. When I first started doing physio, I worked for a physiotherapist for 10 years too, doing exercise therapy. We used to think crunches were good for the back, and they really weren't. They're not bad, but they're not the whole story. Think of all the muscles in your core act like a girdle and really support and hold this area in, and that's what helps back pain and all those sorts of things.
So would you say that working out with like your
Yeah, body stuff. Oh yeah, there's tons of stuff that you'll kill yourself. You get great workouts. You'll like some of these, these very new dynamic, sorts of movements of balance and various push-ups. Those sort of things are highly beneficial. You don't have to spend thousands of dollars in gym equipment at all. No. So when we're talking then about this relationship of muscles to the axis, and I will come back to this story over and over again a few times, then there are certain movements that muscles can cause, and we have names for those. Okay? Now we already learned ipsilateral and contralateral stuff, but we also can say a muscle is a flexor, an extensor, a dorsiflexor, a plantar flexor, whatever it may be. When we say a muscle is doing flexion, flexion is represented by a decrease in angle, right? So I have a long angle here. It's getting smaller as my elbow flexes. So we say flexion is bending or decreasing the angle between the bones or parts of the body. And in most joints, this is an anterior direction. One of the places where it isn't is the knee. It's actually posterior. But hip flexion, elbow flexion, shoulder flexion is all anterior, right? I'm decreasing the angles. Extension is the exact opposite. I'm increasing the angle. So this was flexion. This is extension. And it generally tends to be in the posterior movement. Okay? Except for the knee. Shoulder, this is also extension. So flexion is decreasing the angle, and extension is increasing the angle. Now, there's some unique movements that occur only in the foot, and this is dorsiflexion and plantar flexion. Dorsiflexion is flexion of the ankle joint, which lifts the front of the foot and toes off the ground. So So heel walking, dorsiflexion. Plantar flexion is the exact opposite. It's flexion of the ankle joint with movement of the front of the foot to the toes towards the ground. So walking on your toes is plantar flexion. Okay? Or you can say this, you could say that that's plantar flexion and that's dorsiflexion. Okay? Because of the way they're made. They're a bit different. Because don't worry. It's the larger answer that just go with the flow. It's okay. Now there is hyperflexion and hyperextension, and of course anybody here dancers or gymnasts? So you all probably have, you can probably bend your elbow backwards and put your thumb on your forearm and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So those are called hyper because they're beyond the normal range of motion, right? So we call them hyper because they're much larger movements than not. Abduction and adduction. Abduction means away from the body. And I always remembered it this way. Adduction, A-D-D is add. So I add it to the body. Abduction, adduction. And I will say it that way in class because abduction, adduction, you'd go, which one are you saying? So I always say abduction and adduction so it's quite clear when I'm suggesting what the movements are. Okay? Circumduction, it's a circular movement that involves sequential movement, so it's not a true anatomical movement. In order to circumduct, you must have flexion, abduction, extension, and adduction in a particular pattern that allows for this movement to occur. If any one of those things is missing because of pain or dysfunction, then you can't circumduct. So you need all those movements in order for circumduction to occur. You can do it in the shoulder. You can do it in the hip joint, right? So you have to have all those movements. Rotation, we've already talked a little bit about. It is turning or revolving a part of the body around its longitudinal axis. So for those physics folks, what's a longitudinal axis? Along it, right? So, for example, if you think of my forearm, okay, so scapula, this is the humerus. This is the upper, what you would call, what's that? Shoulder blade, no longer, it is now the scapula. This is the upper arm, which is the humerus. So it's a ball on this proximal aspect of the humerus, and we can see that it's convex. And then the inside here of the scapula is concave. So the ball fits in the convexity. This is rotation. So you can see it's traveling along that axis longitudinally. Everybody follow that? Is that? It does. It can go like this. It can go like this. It can go like this. It can go like that. Yes.
I think
it does. It actually does. The second one, I don't know if you guys have done this in lab yet, pronation and supination. You done that? In the anatomical position with the palms face forward, the hands are supinated. And the best way to remember it is soup, a bowl of soup. Okay? So this is supinated, this is pronated with the back. When a body is on a massage table face up, they are in the supine position. When the body is laying face down, they are in the prone position. Same terminology. So supinate, pronate. Okay? And again, all these actions are caused by muscles. And the relationship of the bones to each other. Do you remember anatomy class? Structure governs function. So the shape of the bones, the relationship of the ligaments, the placement of the muscles ensures either no movement in a particular direction and or lots of movement in another. Okay? Eversion and inversion, again, are related to the foot. Okay? Eversion is the sole of the foot away from the median plane. In other words, bringing your little toe up towards the ceiling is eversion. And inversion is bringing your big toe up towards your midline. So this is my foot. This is my big toe. Inversion. Eversion. Okay? And sometimes, just to confuse things, you will see supinate sometimes in the foot. So when you're buying running shoes or you're runners, most of you are probably supinators. How many people here are flat feet? If you have flat feet, you're a supinator. So your foot rolls in, so you're actually everted most of the time. Hence the reason why you need orthotics to get that arch back up again, right? The hand also has opposition and reposition. So my ability as a human, because of musculature and the joints of my thumb, I'm able to take my thumb and reach across and touch my little finger or my fourth or my third or my second. This is known as opposition. There are those scientifically who say the reason why humans have gotten as far as they are is because they can oppose. Opposition is what allows us to hold a hammer, a screw, write with a pen, unless you write like that, which lots of people do. Okay, but there is another primate that does oppose. Does anybody know? Yes, the orangutan. Yeah, they're able to oppose. But why didn't they build tools? They do use tools, though. They're rudimentary, but they do use tools. Right? So if you looked at a chimpanzee, for example, the way their muscles are, so if you just look at your hand in the relaxed position, your thumb's kind of forward, right? Chimpanzees, their thumb's back here like this. They can't reach over and grip. The only way a chimpanzee can grip is like this. Now, there are certain times when patients have a certain kind of stroke or a neurological condition. We used to call it monkey hand. Really inappropriate. Yeah. But I did have a gentleman who had a neurological disease I used to treat all the time, and Bob couldn't use his thumb. So literally, to brush his teeth, he would have to grab the toothbrush like this and brush. He couldn't grab a toothbrush any other way. The thumb was completely useless to him. In fact, the muscles here in the sphenoid eminence didn't exist. I could see the bone of his thumb because that muscle was completely gone because of the neurological condition he had. So he always walked around like this. He grabbed everything like this, even a cup of drink, those sorts of things, right? Yeah. What's that? Yeah, take your thumb away and try to do anything. It's pretty difficult, right? Yeah. Reposition is taking that opposed thumb and finger and bringing it back to normal again. So opposition, reposition. The next are protrusion and retrusion. So my ability to stick my jaw out is protrusion, to pull it back is retrusion, okay? Similarly, is protraction and retraction. You put your left arm in, protraction. You pull your right arm back, retraction. Okay, yeah. Protraction, retraction. Okay. You can also use sometimes in the head, protraction, retraction, although we tend to have different names for this, but you get the idea. And then elevation, depression. Okay. So these terms are going to come back over and over again when I say to you, this muscle finds attachment here and here. Protracts, it retracts, it elevates, it depresses, it laterally rotates, medially rotates, whatever it does. Whatever it does, that's why all these terms are important. Now, surface anatomy, we talked a little bit about this. This is the understanding of what lies under the skin. I kind of talked a wee bit about this on Monday. This can be done through touch. Now, touch is known as palpation or observation. So I could bring anybody up here and ask them to take their shirt off, and you would note that, you know, you would see the skin, but you would see lumps and bumps and all sorts of things, right? Sort of looking like this, right? We'd see all these variations in the skin. We can see a picture of a normal anatomical position here, and I, myself, can look at all those and tell you exactly what those structures are, or what all those little lumps and bumps are. You will as well at some point. This is why you spend so much time in the lab, touching each other, palpating each other, working on structures. So you will be able to look at this person that you might be treating today, and they have a condition where one of the muscles is what's called atrophy, and it's gone, it's disappeared. You're going to know what a normal arm looks like so well, they'll take their shirt off, and you'll go, holy crap, their triceps is missing. C5. Problem at C5. Okay? I know it seems a bit crazy now, but believe it or not, you will get there. Right? You'll be able to look at it. Yes. Dude, everything I talk about, everybody's got. It just might have an inch or two of, like, everybody here's got a six-pack. It's a little under there somewhere, but it's still there. Right? So we all have what I'm talking about. You're right. It can be difficult depending on the size of the individual. It does pose a challenge. But here's the thing. I don't care if you're 400 pounds or 98 pounds. Once I touch you, I know where I am. Now, I can palpate a structure through a winter coat because I've been doing this for 28 years and my fingers are pretty sensitive. You will eventually get there over practice, practice, practice. See, what happens is you have something in your brain called the homunculus. And the homunculus, you ever seen the picture of the guy who's got the big head and the big hands and the little arms and tiny little legs, right? It looks kind of weird. That represents the parts of the brain and how much conversation goes on between the brain and those structures. So our hands, they are somewhat sensitive, but through practice and practice, you develop pathways so that you can touch things so sensitively and find structures underneath the skin. Because you're going to be, you know, seeing a patient that says, I hurt here, and you're going to be able to put your thumb or your finger in there, know what normal feels like, because you're going to be working on each other day after day after day and week after week after week through the program. You'll know what normal is, and you'll touch your patient and go, well, that's not normal, right? And we want you to be able to do that. Well, you won't say that to the patient, but in your mind, you'll go, okay, something's going on here. Sometimes you can touch a muscle. Everybody know what dry rot is? You ever touch like a step that's been outside of the cottage and you put your thumb through it and it just, well, guess what? There's certain muscle conditions where you'll put your thumb in the muscle and it'll feel just like dry rot. Right? You'll feel lumps and bumps and high tension in muscles and all sorts of things, right? So again, that's just practice. But from an observation point of view, you can see that in this drawing, you can see, you know, the artist has sort of drawn in the shading, so you get the sense of the curvatures and the alterations and elevation in this individual. And you can see all those little things with all the words around it, they all represent structure. So no, it's a curse. By the way, this is a curse. Once you take this course, you will never look at another human body again the same way. You will look at them and go, oh, he's got weakness in his hip flexors. Oh, she's got no. Because everything will start to show up. It becomes a bit of a curse. You can see these alterations. But yeah, exactly, right? So just realize that looking at a body just with the skin, you can glean a lot of information. Everything you are is represented under that skin, okay? This is with the skin removed. So this is a drawing the artist has done. The skin has been completely removed. It's exactly the same as this arm with the skin on it. There is no difference. So you are going to be palpating in class, and you are going to be told how to get there, how to touch it, and you're going to put your partner on the table, and you're going to work on finding that structure, and then they're going to find it on you, and then you're going to go touch somebody else and touch their structure to see if it's different than the last person you touched. That's why you never have the same partner in lab. You're always changing because you get a better sense of how do people feel? Because we all feel different, right? We all feel different. And that's what makes you getting ready. It makes you kind of understand the differences and get ready for treating other people. Okay? All right. Now I have a weird slide. You don't have to take any notes for this one. A long time ago, I was married to a woman, and for Valentine's Day, she took me down to the city, and we went to the Royal Ontario Museum. Now, I'm a science geek, so I hadn't really seen bones of dinosaurs before. No, I hadn't gone before. So I'm walking around, and I'm looking at all these different dinosaurs. And you go, why is Brian showing us pictures of dinosaurs? So, first and foremost, structure governs function. evolutionarily, these are experiments on themes. But what I want you to understand is, when we look at these structures, they're not dissimilar to us. Right? You can see here in this hip, in this knee, we can see we have an ankle joint. We do have a knee joint here. We have a scapula, right? We have vertebrae that look almost exactly the same as ours. So this idea that we are unique in the universe or in our world, we're not. The experiments that were created through evolution were created to make things more efficient, which allows us to be more survivable. So when we look at what we are inside, lumps and bumps and processes and all the things that make us who we are, they are not unique to us. They have been around for, how old are these things? Millions. These models were created millions of years ago. Have we modified them? Absolutely we have. But they came from this. Now, when we go back to structure governs function, carnivore or herbivore? Why? Right. It's obvious, right? There's an alteration to have the appropriate teeth to rip through muscle tissue to eat it. Whereas herbivores have really flat. Anybody here ever shot deer or moose? Any hunters here? They're herbivores. Their teeth are very flat, large, almost like all molars. And their whole point is to break down cellulose and break down leaves and so they can eat. Structure governs function. What about this guy? Actually, not an armadillo, believe it or not. That's millions of years old, right? This creature, for protection, for survival, decided to build this big shell, okay? Now, what would have to happen to this animal in order to function and get around? What alterations need to be done in order to carry that? Yeah, bigger joints, thicker bones, larger muscles, right? Yeah. So structure suggests that we need it. We're the same way. We have alterations in our anatomy, and if we didn't have them, we'd be walking around like this all day because our head would weigh so much, or we would have to have these big, thick legs and arms to carry ourselves around if we didn't have these alterations because we'd be too heavy under gravity. So always remember, whatever we're talking about or whatever I'm introducing you to, you know, we've got bones that are shaped like this. Bones that are shaped like this. We got bones that are shaped like this, right? They're all for a purpose. Okay, they're there for a reason. They're what allows us, because we're what's called bipedal. What does that mean? We walk on two legs. Why don't we walk on four? Yeah, but why did we evolve? Do you know what that theorists say? We get our heads up above the savanna and the tall grasses, and we can see if there's any threat coming. Okay, that's one of the theories. What's that?
I was saying we can reach the tall fruit.
You can reach the tall fruit. Why does a giraffe have a neck that's that long? Hey, does a giraffe have any more cervical vertebra than a human being? No. It's exactly the same number. They're just more massive. Okay? Just more massive. But they're there for a reason. A giraffe adopted, right? I need to eat up there. That's where all the good food is because I'm slow and lumbrous. So by having a long neck, I can just enjoy my life and eat to my heart's content because nobody else can get up here and eat the food. So you start thinking, evolution does play a role. You can't deny it, right? All these alterations have occurred so that we can survive. That's all it is. So again, I'm looking through all these things. We can also see here, we've got all these air holes in here in the skull. It's so big, if the animal didn't have air holes in it, it would have to have such massive muscles to hold that head up. We're the same way. Our whole face is hollow. You know them as sinuses. We have all these hollow spaces in our head, which makes it lighter so that we can hold our head up. Again, the bones are all similar to us. Ribs, just like us. Again, two bones in the lower leg. We have two bones in the lower leg. Right, teeth again, this is an herbivore. See the difference? Right, and again, holes in the head. Eyes go here. This is the nostril, but the head is hollow. Big scapulas, just like us. Right, there's another scapula there. the point I'm making is that when we look at these things, and there's some things, something here you can watch on your own time, when I talk about all these things, they're not unique to us. They've been around for a very, very long time, and we have just learned lessons of other species and done what we need to do. It's the same, you know, when I was talking about on Monday, I was talking about sexual reproduction. You know, for whatever reason, biologically, we decided that sexual reproduction would be good for us and as our species. Obviously, it's been very successful. So, that all introduction being said, now we're going to get into anatomy, keeping in mind all the things that has kind of gone through with terminology and all those sorts of things. The first thing we're going to do, and this is the way I'm going to approach this course all the time, I teach bones first, then I teach joints, then I teach muscles. So I'm going to introduce you to the systems. We're going to talk about the skeletal system first, then we're going to talk about the joint system known as syndesmology, and then we're going to talk about muscles. Then the rest of the first half of this course is learning all the anatomy, and then when we come back after break, or maybe just a little bit after break, we'll be doing all the physiology of muscles and bones and so forth. So for the next rest of the first part of the semester, it's going to be strict anatomy. Okay? Getting you ready for lab. So, skeletal system. What do bones do? Movement. What do you mean by structure? Okay, stability, what else? You have blood cell production, protection, right, plays a lot of roles. So, protection, such as the spinal cord and brain. Support, provides support to soft tissues and attachment points for tendons and most muscles. Movement, it is the pulling of bones on muscles that results in our ability to walk and move, whatever that movement may be. Storage and release of salts. So, of course, the major salt in bone is calcium. And from a homeostatic point of view, you know, we store and utilize calcium in bone that helps us. So it's the storage and release of salts. Bone stores several minerals, importantly calcium, 99%, and phosphorus. This helps maintain the proper balances of these minerals in our bodies. When we have a lack of calcium in bone, what disease is that? When you have a lack of calcium in the bones, what disease is that? Is osteoporosis, right? Brittle, weak bones, okay? Ladies, especially, postmenopausal. Want to think about that. And then hemopoiesis, which is the creation of red blood cells. So the red bone marrow found in some bones is responsible for the production of red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. So in all of you right now, you are constantly making new red blood cells and old blood cells are dying off. And those are being produced in parts of your body that have what's called red bone marrow. And we'll learn a bit more of where those parts are when we look at bones themselves. There is some triglyceride or fat storage that occurs in yellow marrow. So the red marrow is responsible for red blood cells. Yellow marrow contains fat cells known as adipocytes, and they store something called triglycerides. So if we look here, this is a femur a tibia of the long bone in the leg. If I were to cut this open, it would in fact actually be hollow. And in there, you would find yellow marrow, fatty marrow in this particular bone. If I were to take this bone, this is not real, and cut this open, this is your pelvic bone, okay? This is your pelvic bone. There's red marrow in here, and this is where red bone marrow is found in blood cell production occurs. Also in the sternum is another area, right? There are a couple of areas. As a inside mom, most of your bones had red bone marrow producing blood cells, but as you matured and left mom and got older, only certain bones have red marrow. Many others have yellow marrow in them as far as that goes. And if you've ever considered it, put yourself on the list for, again, getting red marrow for those with leukemia who need stem cell transplants and survive. This is where they stick the needle in right in here, crunch right through the bone, and suck the marrow out. It's the most painful thing ever. Yeah. Because they have to crush through the bone to get into the marrow, and then big needle, they suck it out. Biomechanics. So we've already talked a little bit about this. We say that bones come together to form joints, and I kind of showed you one here when I lined up the scapula, wherever I put it, here. with the humerus, where two bones come together, we call that a joint, right? Joints are the points of movement in the body, in other words, the axis. And we talked a little bit about it here, correct? When we look at the shape of bones that create a joint, there are various types of joints that have various types of movement. Now, in some cases, they only move one way, so they're said to be uniaxial, which means the joint only moves on one plane. In other cases, the relationship between the bones, the two bones, the one bone can move along two planes. That is known as biaxial. And in other cases, depending on the shape of the bones, the one bone can move on many planes, and this is known as multiaxial. So what we need to consider is when we look at a joint, we have to consider its movements and how many axes it has. So this ball kind of represents, a bit crooked, sort of represents a joint, a bone. And maybe I put my hand here and say that makes up a joint, right? We might have a multiaxial joint, which means it's moving on this axis, it's moving on this axis, and it's moving on this axis. Okay? I want another volunteer. So, your shoulder, for example, the shoulder moves on three axes. So, I'll show you the movements first, and we'll figure out what the axes are. So, the shoulder can abduct and adduct. It can flex and extend, and it can rotate internally and externally. So, that means there has to be three axes. Because remember, the muscle has to cross the joint, and it's its relationship to the axes that involves the action. So that means there are muscles that abduct, muscles that adduct, muscles that flex, muscles that extend, muscles that externally rotate, and muscles that internally rotate. It's a relationship to the axes that results in those actions. So let's do AB and adduction first. Somebody come and point to me the axis for this movement. Where's the axis? Come, yeah, but where?
Don't rush, guys.
I'm thinking here.
Not quite, but you're kind of there. So let's think of where the bones are here. Okay, I've got the scapula here, and I've got the humerus here, right? And the bone's rolling this way. So where would the axis be? Yep, so it would be here. See the axis? Right, so I've got an axis that travels right through here. He's spinning around this. I'm moving so they can see. Like you, yeah. So that's moving on this axis. Everybody understand that? So you've got a straight line through here. That's axis number one, right, running anterior to posterior. Okay, now let's do flexion and extension. So actually we're going to turn so they can see your side. Okay, extension and flexion. Where's the axis here? Right there. So you have one here, one here. The last one is, this joint can rotate. Where's that axis? No. It's spinning this way, at the top, right? So we have AB, adduction, flexion, extension, internal, external rotation. So there's three axes in the shoulder joint, flexion, or AB, AD, flexion, extension, internal external rotation. That means we have to have muscles that crosses each of those axes or the action doesn't happen. Does everybody follow me? Okay, I've got muscles that'll come up. If I have a muscle that comes up over here like this, we get rotation. If we have a muscle that comes from under here and attaches here and pulls down, relax, let me pull you. We have extension. If I have a muscle that attaches from the front here to the back and pulls, we get flexion. Right? If I have a muscle that attaches from here and comes, lift your hand up, and comes up to here, I have, adduction. So you have to understand, you've got your axes, the muscle has to cross that axis, however, to affect the change. So when we talk about a muscle, it does this, it does that. you have to start being mindful of where's the axes, what's the shape of the bones, and how do they relate to that axis that results in the movements. Yes? Yes? No? Kind of. Okay. So, yeah, so I have a thing. If you understand it, I'm going to say, do you understand it? If you completely understand it, and you can turn to the person beside you and explain everything to them, it's a 4. If you understand what I'm talking about, but not to the point of explanation, it's a 3. If you understand some parts of what I'm saying, but other parts not, it's a 2. If you don't have a clue what I'm talking about, it's a 1. So you don't have to say anything, just put your hands up. Don't be afraid to put your hands up. Remember I told you that concepts get difficult, some are easy, some are hard. Okay, all right, so sit down. Let's go back to the shoulder. Okay, this is anterior. So this faces this way on my back. Okay, so this is anterior, this is posterior, this is lateral, and this is the proximal humerus. It makes the glenohumeral joint. Okay, so if we think about, did I bring it with me? Oh, I did. There we go. Already got one here. All right. So, again, now we're going to the left side. This is anterior. This is posterior. So, we said this joint can do this. AB, adduction, flexion, extension, and internal, external rotation. Right? All right. So, we've got a couple muscles here. So, we'll turn around here and look at the posterior aspect. I'll use my finger. You'll see there's a bit of a groove here at the top, a bit of a groove here at the bottom. So there's a muscle up here. This is called supraspinatus. Okay? So it travels all the way along the top and attaches to sort of, I don't know why I've got this backwards. That's kind of strange. What happened here? There we go. Nope. I don't know what's happening here. I got it backwards. No, I got it right. I'm anterior on the side. Sorry. So I've got the muscle that attaches itself here in the supraspinous fossa called supraspinatus, and it runs all the way across, and it attaches right on here. So it's crossed the joint, right? So it's going to affect the joint. And because it comes over the top and attaches over here, what axis has it crossed? No, you're close. Abduction one, right. So if we do this into this way, it's crossed over the top here. So therefore, when it pulls, it's going to do abduction because it crossed over the top. Everybody understand that? And it shortens, it pulls up. So it crossed, here's the axis, and it crossed over the axis, and it crossed over the joint, right? If I have a muscle that's back here, it crosses the joint and wraps around over here, comes from here and wraps over there, what axis has it crossed? This one, right? It's crossed that one, so therefore, it's going to rotate when it pulls, okay? Right, so we've done ABA deduction. Now we have to do flexion extension. So if I have a muscle that's back here on the back, and it kind of, this one's a bit complicated because it has to cross in a weird way, and it won't make sense to you at first. But a muscle comes around and it attaches, it does this little twist and it attaches on here. So it's come from posterior and it's come around anteriorly. When it contracts, it's going to pull back here into flexion. Right? If a muscle's here and to the front around here in the chest wall and attaches here on the front, it's going to pull. Everybody understand? Yes.
So this would be a
this shoulder is a multiaxial joint. Very correct.
All joints have all of those. Like
no, correct.
So not all of them would have.
Your elbow. Your elbow, for example, is your elbow joint, okay? So let's take. Okay. So this is. Actually, I found this in the garbage the first day I worked here. You know, A, you're not allowed to throw it out because it's human remains. And B, I took it. Thank you very much. I was quite happy with it. Okay. So this is the humerus. Okay, this is where we're talking about the shoulder, multiaxial. So let's talk about the elbow. What is it? Uniaxial. Yeah. It only has one movement, flexion and extension. So you've got the ulna, okay, and it does this, flexion and extension. It doesn't do any other movement, right? Locks right in, doesn't it? Almost looks like a
wrench.
Yeah. Correct, it does. It locks in. Okay? Anybody here do jiu-jitsu? Any jiu-jitsu folks? So you know what jiu-jitsu is all about? You learn anatomy so you can figure out how to pull a joint in a direction it's not supposed to go, right? The whole purpose of it, right? Exactly. Okay? It's a whole method that was done. How to put a joint in a place it's not supposed to go. And it hurts. Okay? So, again, structure governs function. See, you've got this nice convexity here with this whole concavity here. Locks right in. All it does is that. So that means you have muscles in the front that flex, muscles in the back that extend. Okay? It's all about the shape of the joint, the relationship between the bones, and the relationship of where the muscle crosses the axis of said joint. So if we're going to talk about the elbow, biceps has to cross the elbow joint in order to flex it. Biceps has to cross the elbow joint and attach down here in the forearm. If it doesn't cross the elbow joint, it wouldn't flex. The same with a triceps. Triceps comes down and crosses onto the olecranon of the bone of the forearm, crossing the elbow joint, which results in extension. Yeah. Yep.
Would that be present in the elbow? Like, is there
nope.
Okay. No, because there's no medial plane? Or like,
correct. There's no, if, come on.
Isn't it towards the trunk of the body?
Yeah, but you've got to remember, you've got to think about that frontal plane. AB and adduction only occurs in the frontal plane. If I take this elbow, right, can it do...
No.
That it can't, right? We have the shape of the bones and the ligaments prevents that elbow from moving in AB adduction in that frontal plane. It can only move in the mid sagittal plane in flexion and extension. Structure governs function. It is the shape of the bones and the relationship of the ligaments and the muscles that only allows that movement to occur. What's important to understand, and I have little what I call back pockets for you to kind of hang on to for later on in the program and you remember. Injuries. When we look at injuries, football's coming up, okay? So, I'm not going to hurt you.
Don't worry.
Okay, no. What's your name?
Paige.
Okay, so I've got Paige here, and suddenly we're playing sports, and I slam. She's locked in, you know, she's playing hockey, and her hand's caught, and I slam in this way. What's going to happen? Right, because there's ligaments and bones that are holding the joint in such a way, if I apply a force enough to take that joint out of there, that's where ligaments tear, muscles tear, and we get what's called an injury. Football, right? Guy comes in and tackles, bring your foot for your to plant, so you're equal, hits that knee that's planted. Is the knee supposed to go in that direction? No. So all the holding elements, and again, the shape of the bones, this is where you get into the terrible triad. Medial collateral ligament, medial meniscus. You probably all heard this stuff, right, in football injuries, that kind of stuff. Okay, so it's called the mechanism of injury. So whenever anybody comes to you and they've hurt themselves, it's not a silly question to say, how'd you hurt yourself? Because here's a question for you. I'm digressing here a bit, but you're driving the car, okay? Head-on collision versus a hit from behind versus an impact from the driver's side versus an impact from the passenger side. What's the difference between those? You already know, just intuitively, different energy is going to hit the body in different ways, right? So that means that some structures that are damaged are going to be different for each one of those impacts. So even as simple as a blown out knee or dislocated finger or whatever, you need to get in the habit of saying, what happened? Well, I was doing this and that. And it helps you go, oh, that's likely this or likely that. Thanks, Paige. Okay? So this is why it's all important to understand this relationship. But just know that it is the shape of the bone that results in it only having one axis, two axes, or many axes. And in the body, there's examples of all three of these, depending on what one we're talking about. So again, we'll get back to those when we're introducing to the new ones. So we can see here, you know, ball and socket here in the hip, which we use in the shoulder when we're looking. Got the radius, we've got the ulna and the humerus here at the elbow. We've got the saddle joint here of the between the thumb and the metacarpal that allows for the various movements that the thumb can do and so forth. And I'll be introducing you to all these as we move through. Okay, let's take a break. I'll see you guys at just about the top of the hour. Just about the top of the hour. You know what that means? Okay. Okay, here we go. So, let's look at bone. So, this is a humerus. This is a tibia. Where's my femur? There it is. No, because they're kind of dead. You're hurting a dead person. And they're almost about the same size as me. Pretty close, right? In fact, I can even take their jaw and it almost fits exactly. So they're probably about the same size as me. It's probably a male. No, you can't get live skeletons anymore. No, because what happened about 5 years ago, they discovered that the Chinese were taking their criminals, and when they had capital punishment and killed them, they'd process the bodies and sell their skeletons for profit. And it completely shut down the live skeleton market. Unfortunately, also, a lot of the old skeletons that are out there, you know where they're from? India. Many of them are from India. Still is? Yeah. Many of them are from India. But yeah, the Chinese ruined it for everybody because you can't get real bones now at all. They're so hard to get. That's why I hang on to these with. Oh, the Uyghurs. Yeah, some of them were Uyghurs, yeah. Okay, structure of bone. So we have to name certain parts. We'll start with the long bone. This is considered a long bone. This is the femur, the upper leg bone. So the first is we can see that we have cartilage that's on here. So obviously the cartilage is long gone. It's soft tissue. It would have decomposed a very long time ago because it was soft tissue. But where you find cartilage in most cases in bone is where the articulation of two bones meet. In the case of the femur, it would have surrounded the ball here in this proximal portion, and it would have covered these two condyles, which help make up the knee. Would have been cartilage here, but again, long gone. Bone marrow, so these two here, these are actually cow bones that I've cut because they're easier to kind of see through. And they're hollow in the center, which is this, and there'd be a marrow in there. There is a skin on the bone, of course, again, because it's soft tissue, has long since decomposed and disappeared, but there is a skin on the bone, and that is known as the periosteum, and it has a very important role in living bone. We'll get to that later, but there would have been a skin. Now, this periosteum, the skin, does not cover areas where there's articulation. So where the articular cartilage would have been, there's no skin there, but there is here. Interesting about the periosteum, it's one of the most sensitive tissues in the body. What hurts when you break the bone isn't the bone itself, it's the periosteum that gets damaged when the bone breaks. And that's why if I kick you in the shin, because the bone is so close to the surface of the skin, you're actually putting trauma on the periosteum, hence the reason why it hurts so much. And when we have a true bone bruise, it's usually the periosteum that's been torn and bled a bit. That's the bruise.
What's the hyaline
cartilage? That is articular cartilage. Oh. And we're going to get way into that coming up. Don't you worry about that. We're going to spend some time on that. So, we're going to use the definitions here. The first thing you'll note on this bone, it has a very long shaft here down the middle. That is known as the diaphysis. So the shaft is known as the diaphysis. It's the long portion. You'll notice at either end of the diaphysis are these two unusually shaped areas. They're the ends of the bone. These are known as the epiphyses, or singularly the epiphysis. So this and this is considered the epiphysis, and on either end of the diaphysis shaft, we find the two epiphyses. Okay? The metaphysis is in where we see, the metaphysis is a region in mature bone where the diaphysis meets the epiphysis. So where the two come together, we find what's known as the metaphysis. Now, most of you, maybe a couple of you still, do we have any under 20s here? Okay, so you still have metaphyses. Those are known as the growth plates or the growth areas. Not every bone has one. They all have various times where they close. So this one closes relatively early, but this is the area where bone grows. Obviously, you're much larger now than when you came out of mom. Your arms are longer, your legs are longer. Well, how did that happen? The bone grows, and it grows in width, and it grows in length. The area where it grows in length is this area where the epiphysis meets the diaphysis. This is known as the metaphysis. This is the growth plate, also known as the epiphyseal plate. So this is where growth occurs. When this bone developed inside mom, because I want you to wrap your head around that, as big as this was inside mom. Well, this big at one point in its existence, right? It was made of cartilage. And there was a model, a cartilage model that eventually became the femur. We're going to learn in bone growth, which we'll take in the second half, we need blood supply in this cartilage in order for bone to start to be created. So what happens in the cartilage model is a blood vessel penetrates the cartilage, and then we start getting bone growth. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you can see the two orange spots. Those areas where the artery actually went into the cartilage model inside mom is still there. And an artery travels through that tiny little hole into the bone. This is known as a nutrient foramen. So that blood vessel supplies the bone. We always look at bone as being hard because we only ever see it when it's dead. Bone is alive. Bone in a normal living person is very much alive, which means that it has cells in it that are dividing, and it has, in those cells, tissues that have metabolic needs. You're going to hear me say that a lot. Metabolic needs means it needs nutrients, vitamins, minerals, all sorts of things in order to function properly, and a blood supply which brings oxygen and many other things to this live bone. Okay? So small little arteries go in these little holes known as the nutrient foramen. The epiphyseal is supplied by epiphyseal arteries. So the diaphysis is supplied by these nutrient foramen. And again, when inside mom being developed, there were arteries that penetrated into the epiphyses, and they help supply this. But the one thing is to remember, this is alive in you, right? As hard as it seems, we look at a bone we take from a steak or something, right? And we see it as this hard thing, but it really was alive at one point. And I know as much as when you look at it with the naked eye, it looks absolutely solid, like there's nothing there, but there's tiny holes in here with little cells that live all throughout this. And they talk to each other chemically, and they take care of each other through diffusion and so forth to get the nutrients they need to stay alive. If those die, it dies. And you have things like necrotizing osteocells, where in some cases it happens here in the hip bone, where this whole head dies because it loses blood supply, the cells die. Everybody know who Bo Derek is? Bo knows. He was a football player way back when. Anyways, he played football and he played baseball professionally. He was a phenomenal athlete, and he ended up with his head of his femur dying, and it ruined his career because he got, from football, he got hit in a particular way. There's an artery that goes right in here into the head, and it got broken. The head died. So he actually had to have an artificial hip put in when he was 38 years old. It's the only way you can kind of fix it. Bo Jackson, thank you. That's something good. So we can see here we have the epiphysis at either end. We have obviously a proximal one here and a distal one. And then we have the diaphysis, which is the central shaft that we see here. And then, of course, we have the metaphysis here that lies between the epiphysis and the diaphysis. We We can see it here a bit in the drawing. The metaphysis is sort of in this area here. This is an x-ray, and I know this is a very young individual. This is the distal femur, so this is down here at this end. Remember that when you have an x-ray, bone or things that are dense are seen as white, and soft tissue is seen as dark. Well, if this is the distal end of the femur of this individual, why is there space between this bone and this bone before we get to the knee? Because the metaphysis, or the epiphyseal plate, is made of soft tissue. So I know this is an x-ray of a very young person's leg, because this dark area here represents the soft tissue of the epiphyseal plate for bone growth. We can see it there. You had a question? Metaphysis? Yep. It starts inside mom. So that was there when your bone started growing inside mom.
No, I mean like
it's always between, it's always, every bone, depending on the shape, has them. Not every bone, but most bones. So because we're only using the femur as an example, it would have been right around here and right around here, and then it closes up under the influence of sex hormones in some cases. So once females start producing estrogen and males testosterone, as we start to reach puberty, those hormones will start to shut some of these down. Now, the reason why ladies tend to be not as tall and a bit smaller is because estrogen is considered to be more powerful and shuts down your growth plates before us. You guys will start to slow down in growth much earlier than we will as men. That's why we tend to get taller, because our growth plates stay open a bit longer, which allows for our greater height and size. It's just a timer thing, because some get early and some don't, depending. Now, when females are getting, are reaching puberty earlier than they ever did before, there's some reasons for that, some arguments out there that there's certain hormones that we're eating in our regular foods and all those sorts of things are causing females to mature much faster. Yes? It closes and fuses solid. So you can see right here, there would have been a metaphysis on either end of this one, but all you can see here is solid bone. It closed down a very long time ago. I'm trying to remember femur, don't quote me on this. I think the femur stops in females around 14 and around 19 in males, somewhere in there.
Is it different for every bone?
Yes. Yeah, so when I worked in the emerge department, you guys don't know this either. I'm a cardiology technologist. I actually worked in a hospital and clinical setting for quite a long years. So I used to go in the trauma room. I've been in trauma rooms. I've been bled on, puked on, coughed on, spit on, peed on, pooped on. See many people die. I used to do all the CPR in the hospital. Anyways, in the trauma room, there used to be a sheet of paper that would remind physicians of all the epiphyseal plate closures at different periods of time, so that if a child came in with a fracture, they could take a quick look and see where the fracture is and go, oh, that's a problem. It's probably near the epiphyseal plate, and then have to deal with it. Because if a child breaks a bone and does enough damage to the metaphysis, that leg, that bone in that leg will stop growing. So the rest of the leg the child will get longer, and this bone won't. So they have to do things like break it and elongate it to try to get it back to a longer piece. So they actually break it in the middle, put some metal plates in, put some new bone, like promotes bone growth, and fill in the space with bone so that it gets a bit longer. No. Every bone continues to grow.
Now,
not as much as you think. So the skull is kind of unique. It's your face that grows, not your skull. Your skull grows a bit, but the majority of growth is not in your skull. It's your face. Your face long elongates, and the rest of you grows a lot. But if you look at the size of a child's head, like my oldest grandson, dude had a pumpkin. I don't know how my daughter survived it. Because like his head was so big, he had been squeezed so hard during the birth, he looked like Predator. No, he was Predator. He had this big thing sticking out the back. Because his head, like when he got to be like a year old, you had to put 5-year-old shirts on him because you couldn't get his head through the 1 and 2-year-old shirts. Well, his head is massive, right? So your head doesn't grow as much as it's the rest of you that tends to. But many, many bones do. Almost all the bones obviously have to have some form of growth, because obviously you're not the same size as you were when you came out of mom, right? So there was growth that occurred for sure. And again, they do eventually close and become solid, depending on which one it is. Yeah. No, it's right. No, it'll be this dark area here. Remember, bone looks white, soft tissue looks dark. So the growth plate is right here in the dark. Yeah. So you get. We're going to learn it. But think if you've got the two plates of bone with the metaphysis in between, you get cellular division. That the bone gets longer. Okay. Keeps getting elongating that way as cells divide and mature and become functional osteocytes, and then you get larger. That's the epiphyseal plate right there. Yes, correct. Yep. Now, again, if you know, imagine this child was playing soccer or something and fractured right through here. You know, in a soccer match, that could be detrimental to them as far as that goes. It's also the reason why children up until the age of really 16 should not lift heavy weights in the gym, because lifting heavy weights, if it's heavy enough, you'll get shift of plates, which is not healthy. So we don't want children, we want them exercising and getting fit, but shouldn't be in the gym lifting heavy weights until about 16, 17. Yes, correct. No. What do you mean by degrade?
So, will it be mandatory for women to take calcium supplements after
that? No, it's more has to do with hormones postmenopausal. So the lack of estrogen progesterone balances results in the calcium phosphorus problem. So as long as premenopausal women should be fine, because the female sex hormones do help maintain calcium levels. That being said, because females have less dense bone than males do, the idea is that females should do more weight-bearing exercise to promote denser bone tissue. Think of it as like the bank. So females should be banking calcium all their life to make their bones as dense as possible, because all of you will use all females will lose calcium once you're postmenopausal. It's just a natural thing that happens. If you have lots of deposit in the bank, your chance of osteoporosis are far less than if you weren't, okay? And if you don't mind, African-American ethnicity has, Caribbean, which still came from African-America, they genetically have more dense bone, and therefore they don't tend to get osteoporosis as many of those, especially Northern European, Caucasian descent folks. They'll tend to lose more just simply because we have less dense bone than those of African American descent. Right? Okay. So start banking your calcium, man.
Why do they have more?
Why? Structure governs function. A lot more physical labor, those sorts of things can result in it. And again, it was probably part of. Most, if you think about it, sort of from a historical point of view, hunter-gatherer types of societies were much more, there's still hunter-gatherer societies in Africa to this day. I don't know if you know that. So when you're walking every day, working fields, doing whatever, you just build more and more. There is a theory that's a terrible theory. It's a terrible theory. That due to slavery in the U.S., back when slavery was there, the fact that they had to do so much physical labor, the fact that they would try to interbreed, I don't know if you know this from a terrible perspective, but owners of slaves would take the biggest man and the strongest woman and deliberately put them together. It was almost like creating dogs and cows. It's disgusting, but it did happen, so part of that kind of promoted it as well. Okay, so I already alluded to this articular cartilage. So I said at both ends where the bones meet, wherever two bones meet to form a joint, there's always either the form of cartilaginous material there or fibrous material. Two bones come together, there's always something between the two of them, okay? So in the case of the long bone, we have articular cartilage, and the majority of cartilage that covers bones where they meet at joints is a particular type of cartilage called hyaline cartilage, and we'll get into that much later in A&P when we're taking tissues, because it's a type of cartilage, okay? The periosteum, as I said, is the skin. It surrounds the surface of the bone, not covered by the hyaline cartilage. The periosteum is essential for growth and diameter, repair, and nutrition. So it's the real active part. The skin that goes around the bone is extremely active. You ever notice when you cook, you braise like a bone, and you can almost peel the skin off the bone? That's its periosteum in most cases. And it's tough, and you don't really like to eat it. It's kind of chewy. Okay? Sorry? It is. It's only cartilaginous tissue and protein, but it's usually tough and not great as far as that goes. You know, you'll sometimes see it too when you boil chicken for soup. You'll see the stuff peeling off the chicken bones. That's usually the periosteum. Okay. The point of it also is the point of attachment for ligaments and tendons. The muscle that attaches on the bone, as we say, does not actually attach to the bone. The tendon actually attaches to the periosteum, which is attached to the bone. Now, the periosteum on the bone is an extremely strong attachment. It's very strong. Think of, you know, big weightlifters, you know, can lift huge amounts of weight, and they're putting a real strain on those tendinous attachments while they're performing the exercise. You don't see the tendon ripping off the bone unless it's really heavy, because you'll see that occasionally in powerlifting where athletes will attempt a certain weight, and you'll just... It just literally pops right off the periosteum, because it the weight is so heavy, it overstresses the muscle tension, and something has to give, and the tendon just pops right off. Yeah. Why is why I ask, right? So this skin on the bone has two layers to it. So the periosteum has two layers. The first is the outer layer. The outer layer is called the fibrous layer, and it is made of irregular connective tissue. It does contain the blood vessels, lymph vessels, and nerves. So this is the area that if you do damage to it, it hurts. So the outer layer is called the fibrous layer, and this is what I said, where we find the blood vessels and the active sort of outer part of it. The inner layer is what's called the osteogenic layer. So let's do some terminology. Osteo means bone, and genic means... Sorry? Origins or creation, right? Okay, so this is where deposition of calcium, growth of bone occurs, is on the inner layer. So therefore, we have elastic fibers in here. We do have blood vessels, but we have our types of bone cells that live in there. So we have bone cells that become bone cells and that create the matrix, what we call, that create the bone itself. We have other cells that maintain bones, tissue, and then we have other cells that dissolves the calcium in bones for you to use in your body processes, right? So they tend to exist here. So we can see, here's the articular cartilage here on the ends. We can see here in the periosteum, we've got an outer fibrous layer and an inner osteogenic layer, and you can see it all attaches to the outside of the bone that we can see here. Outer, again, the blood vessels and nerves. The inner here has these bone cells that are actively creating bone, breaking down bone, and so forth. The second is what's called the medullary cavity, and I've shown this to you a couple of times. I mean, you don't see it here in this femur because it's completely intact. But again, if you cut a piece off, which I did in the cow bone, you can see that it is actually hollow inside, and this cavity is known as the medullary cavity. Okay, this hole in the center. It does contain fatty marrow, yellow marrow in adults. So what you find in here is kind of like a... And does anybody here eat bone marrow? It is the most amazing thing in the world, isn't it? So that's the fatty yellow marrow. You guys haven't tried it? So now if you're kind of bougie, you go to the restaurant and they cut it lengthwise. Yeah, and they put salt on top of it, and they put it under the broiler, and they bake it, and you just spread it on toast. Oh, it's so good. No, that's got meat in it. It's unctuous, is what I say. It's also used in ramen. Like they'll put the marrow in ramen, which gives it that silky kind of so good. Yeah. So if you look at medieval period in England. That you actually, every kitchen had marrow spoons, little tiny spoons that you would dig the marrow out, and they spread it on toast or crackers. It's really good. I know you're a vegetarian. Now, we had a skin on the outside of the bone. We also have a skin on the inside of the bone. And because it's the inside, it is endo, which means within. Right? See how terminology keeps coming back? Okay. So at the endosteum is the skin on the inside, and it contains something called osteoprogenitor cells. Now, osteoprogenitor cells are not a bone cell, but they can become a bone cell. So let's say, for example, you broke your leg and you broke the bone. You need to repair that. Well, the creation of new bone comes from osteoprogenitor cells. They differentiate into what's called an osteoblast, which creates what's called the matrix, and you build new bone to repair where the fracture was. So that's why these are sitting in here. So you have this, again, you have this inner skin. So here's our periosteum here on the outside, and then we have this inner skin here on the inside in the medullary cavity, inside this area here, okay? Not bad. We're moving along. We might actually get everything done. So are you feeling it yet? I know it. It's a lot, right? It's a lot. I get it. That's the reason why I sat with you. Okay, so kind of showing you a few. When we are dissecting humans, again, coming from the perspective of standardization of medical terms and the scientific method and so forth, when we start taking bodies apart, we started recognizing that, you know, we had bones that were flat like this, long and round like that, kind of semi-flat, and who knows what shape that is. Things that had all kinds of different shapes on it, right? All different configurations. And we had to standardize this so we knew what we were talking about. So we had to classify bone based upon certain criteria, size, shape, and so forth. So the first was a long bone. And that's what we've been looking at when we were looking at the introduction of bone here with the femur. So a long bone is tubular in shape. It does have a body or a diaphysis, which we just looked at. It has two expanded ends, of course, which are the epiphyses that we just talked about. It's longer than it is wider, which makes sense when you look at it here. It is considerably longer than it is wider. It is a lever. It is a very important lever. Everybody know what a lever is? If you took physics, you know what it is. If you didn't, you don't know what the heck I'm talking about. But a lever makes functional things more efficient. So it is the length of the femur and the tibia that does allow us to move forward and ambulate and walk. But the shape of it also, as a lever, makes less muscle work for us to do the things we do just simply to walk. So it works as a lever. It provides for muscular, ligamentous, and tendinous attachments. It does provide large articular surfaces for shock absorption. So imagine the pounding that knee takes, even just walking up and down the stairs going for a run. So you see we have these big, heavy epiphyses here that... There are other modifications that occur here, but even these large bones, they can deal with that day-to-day pounding of walking and running or whatever we're doing and do pretty well, okay? So they're there for that. So these are the femur of the leg, humerus of the arm, the ulna, and the tibia of the lower, the tibia and the fibula of the lower leg. This is the forearm. Metacarpals are in the wrist. Metatarsals are in the hand, and the phalanges, of course, are the fingers themselves. They're all considered to be long bones when we go by that definition. We can see it here. All in the blue represents long bones. Next are short bones. They tend to be cuboidal in shape. How long is this one? This one. Here's the hand here. So you can see all these little tiny, irregularly shaped bone. This is actually your wrist. So this is fingers. And these are all these little bones right here. These are all considered short bones. You think I'd have fun at Halloween, wouldn't you? Okay.
I'm just trying to see how
the palm. So if I were to lay this out appropriately, that's kind of the palm is this area here, and it's right here in the wrist. Okay. So they're all these little teeny tiny bones. They're considered short bones. They tend to be cuboidal in shape, meaning they're like a roll of a dice, six sides, right? They all have six sides. They all do. You only find them in the foot and wrist. In the foot, they are known as tarsals or tarsal bones. And in the hands, they are known as carpals or carpal bones. Everybody's heard of the carpal tunnel? Okay. So based upon the fact that it's the wrist. As I said, they have six surfaces. Four are for articulation, and the other two are for attachments of ligaments. So let's, in our mind, think about a dice. You know, you're playing a board game or something. You've got that six-sided dice. Okay? So put the dice in your mind on the floor or on the table or your desk and realize that you have one, two, three, four surfaces for articulation with other bones, and then the surface that's on the table and the surface that's pointing at the ceiling, that's four attachments for ligaments that hold it all together. And the other four all touch other bones form articulation. It is the articulation between these small bones that allows for this massive dexterity that our wrist and hand has to perform the many tasks that we do with our hands. Without those bones, we wouldn't be able to have all the movements that we have in the wrist, which allow the hand to function in the many ways that it does. So we see here the metacarpals are here in the hand, metatarsals down here in the foot. Next are flat bones. Now, flat bones are two plates of compact bone with spongy bone and marrow in between. Now, there is this marrow space between the two hard bones is known as diplo. I will pass this skull around, and you will see that on the inside of the skull is very compact hard bone. On the outside, very hard bone. But if you look down in between the two, you'll see tiny little holes, almost like sponge toffee, and that represents the soft bone in between, and that has red marrow in it. Okay? In the holes, it contains red marrow. All right? They function to form walls of cavities. What's interesting is if tell me how something this round can be a flat bone. But it is, because it's flat from this perspective. Okay? So they're not necessarily flat, but they do have curves in them. They provide huge surfaces for muscle attachments. The scapula, where's the good one? Here we go. This is considered a flat bone. So you can see it has a huge surface area for muscle attachments. In fact, there's a lot of muscles that attach on this, just this tiny little bone. Quite a few of them. That's for next semester. But there's a lot that attach it. But this is also considered to be a flat bone. Note that it has a curve to it, yes? Okay, there's a bit of a curve to it. They provide broad surfaces for muscle attachments, such as the scapula, the cranial bone, which you're passing around, your sternum in the front is a flat bone, scapula, and your ribs are considered a flat bone. Don't ask me why. I told you sometimes I think they were smoking good stuff when they were doing dissections, but they consider a rib to be a flat bone. Tell me. I guess when you look at it, I guess it's conceivable that maybe you would consider that to be a flat bone. Yeah, the whole rib is considered a flat bone. And you can see out here it's a bit flat, but not so much in that end. I don't know.
Do they look together?
No, each rib is considered a flat bone, yeah. It does create a flat surface, yes, but no, it's the bone itself. So we can see them here, sternum, cranial bones, and the ribs. And here you can see, like in the skull, although it's quite tiny in what you're looking at, you can see the hard compact bone on either side, with a little bit of spongy bone in between the two. Why do you think that's there? Why not just have one solid bone in your head? Why have that little bit of space in between? Yes, makes it lighter. Makes it a bit lighter, shock absorption. Although you can have something called a ping pong fracture. Anybody ever here ever play with a ping pong ball and you hit it and you get that little cave in? If you get a proper impact into the skull, it'll cave just like a ping pong ball. So the bone on the inside will be fine, but the bone on the outside will crush in a little bit into the spongy bone in between. It'll look just like a broken ping pong ball. Pneumatic bones. Pneumo means air. Okay, so these are bones that have air cells or sinuses. What's interesting is the sinuses that were created is where when you were inside mom and the skull was developing, for example, mucous membranes, which your whole upper respiratory tract is lined with, penetrated into the bone and broke these big holes in into the face. No, they're pneumatic. Your irregular has its own. It's on here. Okay. So basically, these air pockets are outgrowths of this mucous membrane. So this skull obviously has been cut in half, right? You're only looking at one eyeball. But you can see how the face here, see all the holes? Look at the size of these holes. Like they're big. Like your face is hollow. Your actual face is quite hollow. And the uniqueness of all our faces, see all the way down in there? Right, that's the cheek. Right, you can see right here and right here. Big hole right here in your head. The uniqueness of each of us is how big these sinuses are that make all our diverse facial differences. Is that? Here, here, right? And of course, one of the roles here is to make sure that this this head is actually quite light and it's not falling down on your face. But imagine you have a head cold and this mucous membrane gets swollen. What's it feel like? You feel like your head's going to blow, right? Because there's so much pressure because there's nowhere for it to go. See, that goes right into the back of the cheek. And there's also here above the upper teeth, there's also another one here that you can't see. See? Your face is all hollow.
That's the sinuses.
Yep, it's your sinuses. Yep. Do you ever get to a point where you got a sinus headache or a sinus cold so bad, you push on your face and it just hurts like heck, right? Because what you're doing is you're pushing on these sinuses. Okay? So, they are outgrowths of the mucous membranes of the middle of the ear and the nasal cavities. The medullary cavities of the facial bones are invaded by mucous membranes. So these are medullary cavities, but instead of filled with periosteum or endosteum, they're filled with mucous membranes. And the whole purpose is those mucous membranes do deliberately secrete mucus so that you're always flushing these out and keeping them clean. The problem is, for lots of reasons, smoking, getting a cold or whatever, these apertures that drain, because all of it goes down your throat. So all of what you create up here does travel back and you swallow it into the digestive system if everything's working right. Anything that narrows them or causes them not to drain, that's when you run into problems. Hence the reason why my voice, I don't normally sound like this. I've been like this for 12 weeks now. So I've got swelling in there and I'm not able to drain. So that's why I have the voice that I have. So that's the other thing. These air sinuses actually also not only make your face unique, they're part of what makes your voice unique. So your voice does arise here from your larynx, but it is the resonance that occurs, like chamber music. Any classical folks here? Does anybody know what chamber music is? Do you know what chamber music is? Are you in band? Were you ever in band? Wow, good for you. It's what gives the sound of our voice, the uniqueness of our voice, as it vibrates through all these air sockets, air pockets that we have in our face. So we can see here, we've got, this is the upper maxillary that we can see here. You can see how it forms in here. And these are the common ones. So two above the eyes, four around the bridge of the nose where it makes contact with the face, and two on either side of the nose just by the upper teeth. Those are kind of our common sinuses. Those are the ones that get all nasty when we get a head cold and they get all swollen. More often than not, when you feel that pressure in a head cold, it's not excessive mucus production. It's that the mucous membranes swell and fill up the spaces, and that's where the pressure comes from. Irregular bones. You were saying? Now, irregular bones have complex shapes, and these are bones where anatomists went, is it a short bone? Is it a long bone? I will call it irregular because it doesn't fit anywhere else. They cannot be grouped. They vary in amount of compact and spongy bone. So certain facial bones are considered irregular, and vertebra, which this is, makes up the spine, this is considered an irregular bone just simply because of its shape. We can see here, this is called the sphenoid that makes up part of the base of the skull. You can see here, and this is the vertebra, and we can see the whole vertebral column. They're all considered to be irregular bones. Sesamoid bones. Do wall beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun. Oh my God, are you guys all that young? Like, did you guys not know that jingle? What was that? Yeah, 12 beef patties, special sauce. Yes. No, you don't remember it? It's meant that it was the McDonald's jingle forever when you wanted a Big Mac. To all beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun. That was the Big Mac. So, somebody thought that these bones look like a sesame seed. And I have two of them. No, actually, I have three of them. You know it as the kneecap, forever now known as the patella. So because of the shape, somebody thought this looked like a sesame seed. So it was called a sesamoid bone. It's smaller than you thought? Yeah, it's because you've got so much soft tissue that surrounds it, it makes it seem larger. You're going to find that with many bones because there's so much soft tissue around bones. When you look at them for real, you go, holy cow, is that ever small? Yeah. Now, it's also depending on, like, my patella would be a bit larger than yours just because of size difference, right? But so, round or oval nodules of bone, they tend to develop where tendons cross joints, right? So they play two roles because you got the one here in the knee. So you got the tendon from the quadriceps that crosses across the front of the knee down to the lower leg. They do provide some protection, but their big role is they change the vector of angle. So when you're in flexion, if your quads are here and your lower leg's there, your tendon's like this. Now, if your tendon was like this, how efficient would it be to get to here? You'd have to produce a lot of power to get past that 90 degrees. By placing the patella in between the two, it allows an anchor point to create a lever to get the leg up that much easier. Just helps it move a bit easier from a mechanical point of view, okay? So we say it protects the tendon from excessive wear. It also changes the angle of the tendon in some cases. The patella is the big one everybody knows, but you actually have two in your great toe. Way down on the bottom underneath, you have two little teeny, tiny, tiny under your big toe, the base of your big toe. You also have one in your wrist called the pisiform, little tiny bone right here. And it's a sesamoid bone as well. Here we go. See the underside of the foot? You have two little tiny bones buried in the tendon here. And, of course, we all know the one here at the patella. It's buried within the tendons of the distal quadriceps group where it goes down to attach onto the tibia. Okay. Bones have lumps, bumps, holes, grooves, ditches, all sorts of things. And they all have anatomical names. So you can see, for example, a fissure is a narrow cliff-like opening. A fontanelle, no, don't worry about the fontanelle. A foramen is an opening which blood vessels and nerves pass. A fossa is a depression where a groove or sulcus is a furrow or depression that accommodates soft structure. A meatus is a tube-like passageway. External auditory meatus is your ear hole. The paranasal sinus we just talked about. Processes or anything that stick out in any direction imaginable. And then the condyle, of course, these two large ends of the femur here are considered condyles. And a facet is a smooth, flat surface. Think of, what do diamonds have? But it's pronounced facets, right? But it's still a smooth, flat surface, isn't it, right? And then, of course, the head can be any rounded articular projection. A condyle, so I might say this is the epiphysis on the distal femur that is made up of a medial and a lateral condyle. Yeah, or both. We can say there are two condyles on the distal epiphysis of the femur. Epiphysis is more the region, any specifics in it. In this case, there's two condyles, but I wouldn't call this a condyle. This is a ball, sphere. It all depends on the shape and what it is, okay? By the way, you'll need to know those for next week. I ask questions on those. Yeah. And again, you're going to come across these terms over and over and over again, depending on what bones we're talking about. So as I said earlier, there are divisions to the axial skeleton. So there are divisions to the skeleton. We have the axial skeleton, which the axial represents a longitudinal line on an axis that runs through the body's center of gravity. The axial division consists of bones that lie in this line. So the skull, which is the head, the auditory ossicles, which we don't really talk about, but you actually have little tiny bones in your ears that help you hear. Hyoid bone, which is in the front of the neck here. The ribs, the sternum, and the spine. This is the semester. The other division of the skeleton is the appendicular skeleton, is all the other bones, the upper and lower extremities, and the girdles that attach the two divisions together. So that would be the shoulder girdle and the hip girdle. There are 80 bones in the axial skeleton and 126 bones in the appendicular. You will know every bone, every lump, every bump, every foramen, every groove, every tendon, every muscle that crosses it, where it attaches, what action that muscle does, and what nerve innervates it by the end of semester two. And ladies and gentlemen, that is our meat and potatoes. If there's anything you need to know as a massage therapist, this is the stuff we work on. This is the stuff you need to know more than anything. Where every muscle goes, where it attaches, what bone is it, what's the lump on that bone, and so forth. Do you notice when I was doing SCM, I said mastoid process, right? You just go to things. You've got to know all these things. It seems daunting. I know it does. But if you really jump into it and really get into it in lab where you're talking it all the time, it'll all start to come so much. A little more difficult is the muscle attachments, but the bony stuff is easy. It's easy to touch. It's easy to touch on yourself, where it is, what it does. We will be focusing, as I said, on the axial skeleton and its muscles, ligaments, etc. this semester. So the blue here is what we're taking this semester, and the blue here is what you will be taking next semester, and you will not have me because I'm on vacation. I get summers off. We're done. That wasn't too bad, was it? It's which compared to Monday? You think so? It was only because it was the first time too, right? Well, yeah, remember I said about contextualizing? That's the big thing, right? This is so much easier to contextualize as compared to what we're taking in AMP. Now, once I leave tissues and cells in AMP and we get into systems, then it becomes a whole lot easier. So, yeah, so I'll let you guys know, I'm a Gemini in the truest sense of the word. I'm a cardiology technologist. I'm a butcher. And I'm a massage therapist. Not at all. Hence the reason why I have all my stories.